This is Tractor Tuesday Live, hosted by sixth generation Nebraska farmer and Tractor Tuesday founder Zach Bosley and Scott Anderson, owner of New Age Ag Supply. Join them each week as they sit down with farmers, innovators, dealers, and creators who are enhancing the culture within agriculture, right here on Tractor Tuesday Live.
Hi, Zach Bosley here with, is it Tuesday? I think that's a work in progress, but I'm with Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply out of beautiful South Dakota, but not currently in South Dakota. Scott, where are you today?
I'm in Indio, California.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's kind of that Palm Springs desert area. So
Taking one for the team down here. Yeah. Left the snow and the Arctic weather for sunny desert weather.
Yeah, all that privilege of being a corn and bean farmer. So,
but I have cattle, so I should be suffering right now, like every other, you know, corn, grain, and cattle farmer. You know, moving hay and getting the cattle all taken care of. But I shipped them to Hastings, Nebraska, your neck of the woods, with the farmer that you found for me, actually.
Yeah. Well, I was hoping to run them on our stocks this year. We just have a little bit going on with some construction and some survey. And I think we lined you up with a good farmer, a good operator, been friends of our family for a couple of generations. And they're excited because you seem to pay a little bit better than some of the other ranchers we deal with out of the Sandhills. So,
yeah. And he, you know, he had had cattle before. Like when you're going to move your cattle to somebody else for a couple months, like there's, but the cattle are so valuable these days that you got to make sure that they're with somebody that knows how to notice that there's something going wrong, so he can get the vet out there or load one up and take them to the vet. You know, they're just, you don't want to just ship them somewhere and forget about them, which I don't think anybody is doing that. But no, it makes a lot of sense for us, you know, to ship the cattle based off of where I am in South Dakota and our infrastructure set up on my farm for cattle. Like I don't have very good winter water facilities, you know, like I just don't have logistics. And it's so expensive to keep them in a sub-freezing environment for, you know, 5 months straight.
The worst of the worst. And how many head did he end up shipping down?
I think it was 143 or 144. Yeah. Okay. The hardest part about owning cattle is counting them.
Because
you're like, you need one of those baseball clickers, you know, that clicks or whatever. Otherwise you just, you're like, was I at 14 or was the next one 14? Crap. You know,
And that's the worst thing about me getting older. When I was younger, I used to have a very strong photographic memory, and I could drive by a feed yard with my grandpa and be like, oh God, there's 48 there. And he'd look over at me and, well, there was 50, but you know, obviously two went. And it's just now that I'm 44, it's just, I can't visually process that like I used to. I can't remember anything. And then staring at my monitor right now, my eyes are just falling apart, and I've always had perfect vision. And I need to get a better monitor for my primary, because my secondary has the blue light reduction. But every little thing is starting to affect me with my advanced age. So
do you wear sunglasses?
I sometimes, I'm ashamed of it because I never did. And then I met my wife, and one of her first gifts she got me 10, 12 years ago was a nice pair of sunglasses. So I don't know if she was trying to say something about my appearance or what was going on. But so I started wearing sunglasses when I met my wife, Rachel. And unfortunately, I wear them semi-frequently. And I think that's honestly weakened my eyes.
I've heard that now. So I quit wearing sunglasses. I haven't worn sunglasses in probably a year and a half to 2 years, you know. And I think that sun, like exposing your eyeballs to the sun, just like exposing your skin to the sun without sunscreen, is actually healthy. Like the sunscreen blocks the vitamin D, and a lot of people are getting cancer from the sunscreen. It seems like, you know, it's like everything that we are taught as kids has come out to be, you know, a lie. Just like with beef, you know, like cattle is beef is the most dangerous thing in the world to eat. You should eat grains. And fruits and vegetables. And now all the research has basically flipped on that, saying beef is like, if you were going to subside on one nutritional product, beef is by far the best thing to do that, do with.
Well, and what I'm pretty confident in, for not being a medical expert and not making any medical claims, or, you know, we should preface the whole show with everything that we're saying. We don't know anything. We're just repeating what other people have said around us. But, you know, a lot of the hardened arteries and everything that they used to attribute to eggs was more so the Teflon type material, the nonstick, was cooking off into the frying, you know, from the frying pan to the egg.
Speaking of eggs.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you loaded up on the haul.
I brought, because we have 500 chickens on the farm. Okay. I brought down 120 dozen unwashed eggs.
Oh yeah,
30 dozen washed eggs. So okay. I brought 150 dozen eggs down to California.
you got to make it, man. And my wife and me are down to, I believe, 5 laying hens. And oh, I think no. At the peak of our insanity, we had 34 for whatever reason. But we're on our second group of girls, and we don't wash them, we don't refrigerate them, we just crack them, and it's a breakfast thing.
Yeah.
Problem is, my son just, man, he hammers them down, and you know, it's hard to keep the family fed. So hopefully at the new house we can kind of move the coop over and have a little bit more of an operation again. But we just do it for fun, you know. For what you guys are doing, it's probably more of a commercial raise, or
We go through a lot of eggs.
Yeah.
And if you're going to have, like, having 30 chickens is a lot, right?
Yeah.
If you're going to have 30 chickens, it's not that much harder to jump up to 200, 250. Mm-hmm. It's actually more efficient, because then afford to buy like so we have a commercial washing machine that wasn't all that much money. I think it was, you know, maybe $8,000 or $9,000. And if we can run through like 100 dozen eggs in an hour, you know, and it candles them and washes them and everything. It just makes the process, if you want to wash your eggs, because we sold eggs for 2 years and then we stopped selling eggs, and now we're just donating eggs. So we donate probably 150 dozen eggs a week to the Salvation Army, to there's two or three pantries that we go around to every week or two when we have a lot. We fill our fridge, and when our fridge gets full, we start calling the Salvation Army, the pantry, and everything, and we just donate them.
Yeah. So what's your facility look like then? Is it, do you have like a kind of a free range area, or like a mobile tractor type setup, or
I have a couple mobile coops that we can pull around with our cattle when they're in pasture, just to help clean up. I mean, that was the whole goal, following the Gabe Brown, Joe Salatin approach of using laying hens to clean up the parasitic environment that your cattle are leaving. So to help with the flies and all this other stuff, because they just dig through the manure. I mean, the minute a cow drops the manure patty, it's covered in flies. Like, covered. And they're just nesting in there and laying larvae and stuff like that. And the chickens will go through and clean all that up in a day or two. So that was the goal. But
yeah. It's amazing to even watch them. And it's at the old farmhouse. I caught this action twice, and I looked out, and this is horrible. And, you know, it almost will steer people away. Our producer's a vegan, and he'll hear this and he'll love it. But I looked out the window one time, and we had a Rhode Island Red or a New Hampshire or something. And I saw it swoop its beak down. It grabbed a very large mouse, maybe a rat, and literally just swung it up and just took it down like a snake. And literally just ate the thing right in front of me in real time as I'm looking out the window. And it wasn't the only isolated incident. Same thing happened. I was irrigating. I was coming back through on my gator into the yard and saw the same thing happen again. And I mean, they literally will just eat anything. Yeah. And it's amazing. They churn out these, you know, highly nutritious eggs. And it's kind of fun. The kids like it. And we just let ours free range as well. But we're not actively living where the coop is. And the new house, we've got a pretty good setup. I'm going to turn the end gun off on the pivot that runs up to the house and give us about 110 to 140 yard buffer area. And I saw some larger, you know, semi-commercial mobile tractors that you can do maybe 200 to 300 birds in.
Yeah.
And then they don't actually move the long way. They're mobile sideways. But it's not like all self-contained. I'd have to hook up a little utility tractor to drag it. Mm-hmm. But that was kind of my idea, is just maybe seed down some alfalfa in that isolation or buffer area, and then kind of get that going and established, and then set up my little chicken operation. But again, what are you going to do with 200 eggs a day? And I'd look into the nonprofit side and try to do a donation. And so do you have like a separate entity set up for the egg donation, or is that just kind of out of the pocket? Yeah.
Yeah. It's just out of the pocket. So, I mean, in the grand scheme of things, when you have a large commercial operation, I mean, buying chicks for $4 a chick,
right?
So you buy 100 chicks and it's $400. I mean, that doesn't even halfway fill your fuel tank on your tractor, right?
No, it's just the feed can kind of add up. And really, I even looked into just using our old grinder mixer when we had a lot of hogs. But I mean, really, the savings wasn't that substantial, you know, to mix your own feed, unless you've found a formula up there.
No, we just buy pallets of bagged feed
from
Runnings or the you know, Tractor Supply or something like
right.
that. I think it's $12.50 to $13 a bag.
Right.
And with our herd size of, you know, 400 to 500 chickens, they'll go through two bags a day. So $30 a day to keep 400 to 500 chickens rolling. So it's really not much, you know, at the grand scheme of things, their cost. The worst thing is the death rates.
Mm-hmm.
So we have you asked about where I've got them. We've got them in a barn, and then we have a door that's open on the barn, and then there's a fenced in area with like chicken fence. So it's like the mesh electric mesh fencing, and it's a huge area. And so they have outside inside access, and then we have five or six geese, and they help with the hawks because we have hawk issues like crazy.
Yeah, we do too.
They get after, but if you have a few geese in there, the hawks don't come near the geese because the geese are so big and the geese are always looking up, it seems. So they'll make a heck of a racket if they see a hawk circling, and the hawk will lose interest pretty quick. But we've also got our cattle. So we kept 10 cows and actually six cows and four bulls that we left back from going down to Hastings.
Okay.
And so we have an area. So they actually share the barn with the chickens. And going back to like one of the hardest things about chickens is keeping them alive because they're so dumb.
Yeah.
We have like a 300 gallon Rubbermaid watering tank for our cattle, which is sitting, you know, in the same barn as the chickens. There's like a little, it's kind of sectioned off, but the chickens have access to the whole barn. So they're going everywhere. And what happens is they'll be perched on the side of the Rubbermaid tank, 300 gallons, and they'll be drinking the water, and then one of the bulls or one of the cows will come in and scare them, and they'll fall in the water and drown.
Oh, geez. I mean, it's hard to explain to city people just the mental capacity of at least from our roosters, that we don't really keep them around too long, but they seem like they've got a few extra points, but they're just stubborn. But man, the girls are just a step above. I don't know, a dandelion maybe is their level of intelligence. They're like a walking dandelion.
They're not smart. So we were losing 4 to 5 a day. And I'm like, guys, we got to figure something out because we can't block the chickens off because they need to go outside.
Right. Know?
And so what I went to one of the farm stores that sells like hog stuff, and they have this plastic hog kind of fence. It's like flooring. And so I'm like, let me try this. So we can build like an island in there. The cattle just push it down and drink.
Right. Keep the water above.
So we did that. We built this like island of plastic flooring inside there because we can't just put a net over it because the cattle need to drink and the net would trap them worse.
Right.
So now they get scared. They fall onto the island and then they can, we can kind of flutter up. So now we're the death rates have dramatically decreased from 4 to 5 a day to, you know, maybe one or two every once in a while.
Yeah. I don't know what to say about it, but yeah, I mean, our first group of girls, I think we might've had 35, and then one of them went, you know, almost instantly. And we had that core group of 34 for about 18 months. And then what we were doing in the wintertime is we'd stimulate with basically just heat lamps that were putting out quite a bit of light and just keeping those going from like 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. Because the wintertime, it's just, it's dark and there's just not those types of, you know, sunlight hours throughout the day. And I think by stimulating, we were keeping the production really consistent. So I think a majority Rhode Island Red, we had some, you know, just kind of run of the mill Tractor Supply, Bumgars type you know, laying hens that we'd get as chicks and, you know, make a little bit of an investment to get them up. And then found a kid that, you know, offered to slaughter them all and just do his thing. So I said, oh, it's better than me putting them out of their misery, because that's quite the ordeal when you do it in bulk. You know, one or two here or there isn't too bad, but to put 30 of them down would be kind of a massacre. So
we just buy replacements every year or two, and then as the old ones die, the younger ones, you know, if we leave them out there for a day, they'll be pretty cleaned up. And then, you know, like they need the protein. They can't just eat that bagged feed, because they're eating bugs and they're eating all this in the summer. But in the winter, they need protein.
Right.
So I tell my guys, you know, if a chicken dies, just leave it there for a day or two and then throw it in the burn barrel.
Yeah.
And then, you know, like I shot a couple deer this fall. So I skin the deer. I take the you know, back straps and hindquarters, and I take all the good meat off. But there's so much like rib meat and stuff like that. Throw it in the chicken coop clean to the bone.
Yeah,
in a couple days.
It's pretty nuts. And we were doing the thing, at least my wife was, where she'd take the old eggshells and then hammer them down so they didn't realize it was an egg, and then we'd bake them, and then we'd feed those eggshell, I don't know what you'd call it, just it's almost like shrapnel at that point, and those shards of eggshell, and she'd just dump them in the run and let them peck and eat at those. You know, it did something, but it was just, you know, we were about a year ahead of the whole COVID thing when everybody got into, you know, trying to be a homesteader and all this fun stuff. We were already doing that. I was prepping for the end of the world in the early 2000s. You know, I've been prepping so long, I'm about ready to dispose of my second hoard of prepping items. You know, just it never ends. We're always here.
If you farm and you're not a prepper, I don't think you can be a farmer and not be a prepper at the same time. Because farming is prep work 24/7. You have to have plan B, C, D, and F at all times. Otherwise, you're not going to get your crop in, or your animals are going to suffer, or whatever. You know, you have to have contingency plans. And prepping is basically just planning for a contingency. You know, if we can't get food from the store, do we have another resource?
Right.
And so it's the same with the farm, right? If it doesn't rain, what's our plan with the animals, with this? Do we have backup hay? You know, like it's all about managing your risk and basically waiting for Murphy to show up and say, hey, this could go wrong. It's going to go wrong.
Well, and a tip for the audience out here, if anybody's listening, but do not hoard toilet paper with aloe, because if you open up that drum about 5 years into it, it makes it deteriorate. So get the best quality triple ply you can get, but no aloe. I thought, oh, this is the best stuff. It's, you know, got the, but now, I mean, we're so down so many rabbit holes. Now my toilet paper is naturally a brown paper. So that's all my wife will buy. And so it's not bleached is the concept. So,
well, you should just have her go out and pick in the cornfield.
Well, just the white
cobs and some of the leaves off the cob, and that'll work just as good.
Well, yeah, just you got to have the white cob. You don't want the red cob, but we don't really raise that many white cob varieties anymore. There was a DeKalb number, and then there was a few Micogen when we were pretty heavy with those guys before Operation Corteva overtook them. But, you know, we had a few white cob numbers that we really like to raise, but pretty much everything's red nowadays. So, yeah.
Awesome. But wife uses the she's got the sprayer have you been outside the country in like Europe and South America or Central America?
I just went to Agrotechnica in Germany, but there was really nothing unique about my hotel room in Hanover. It was pretty
standard. Have a bidet?
It did not. No.
Okay, that's basically, I mean, that's the best way to do it. I mean, as far as the toilet paper thing, and I don't know how we got on this subject, but.
You know, it's part of the deal. We're just kind of a freeform thing. I just, you know, half these other ag type podcasts, I just hit my head against the desk. I'd love to listen to some of these people in general, but, you know, it's kind of the concept of what we're doing here at Tractor Tuesday is we're just doing our own thing. You know, and if people like it, they like it. If they don't, you know, it's just like Nebraska's slogan used to be for tourism. We're not for everyone. And I love that. So anyways, yeah, but no bidets in Germany that I witnessed at least. And I don't have any experience running a bidet, so just kind of a simple hog farmer here in Nebraska.
Yeah, yeah, and I back to like why we're doing this. I agree. There needs to be something that's not, you know, framed around an advertising marketing or people that are just afraid to say how they really feel, whether it's about the ag markets or people in general, politics, so on.
Let's hear about Tractor Tuesday from a customer, Mitchell Fagan.
With it being the buyer's premium, we got what we wanted, and that was the number we got. What number we sold it for, that's what we're getting. That's what matters. It's not like, oh, we got to take 3% off, 4% off. Okay, so what do we need? Do we need 250? Do we need 260? What have you? And so it was simple. It's like, this is a number we got. That's what we're going to get a check for. I would for sure recommend Tractor Tuesday. I would tell anybody, get out there, talk to Tractor Tuesday, try to get your equipment sold that you need to, and you're going to get the most bang for your buck.
TractorTuesday.com.
Yeah, I just thought this could be a good introduction to our audience. We've got a decent following on YouTube. We really don't make social media a major priority. We've got a guy in-house that kind of handles that, and you know, just show a little bit of what we're doing at Tractor Tuesday and some of the people that we interact with, because we've got some real characters around our space. And some people might allege I'm a character, but I'll try to tone it down for what we're doing today. But I think some of the prepping talk, I mean, that might be included in the headline or the description of this episode, kind of an introduction, you know, what we've got going on. And it's just, it's interesting where the conversation kind of takes us, but it'd be interesting to meet your wife or have our wives meet up, because I think there's probably a lot of common ground there. I think it is, and it's more consistent. It's not just me and, you know, you up in South Dakota. It's the majority of what you're seeing on these modern 21st century farm operations are, it's just a, it's almost a, I don't know, a tip of the hat to yesteryears. You're seeing more of that homestead mentality. It's not necessarily a fully traditional, you know, trad wife type experience. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of cringy in my opinion. You know, I think women should be able to do anything that we do if they want to. And that's kind of the cool thing I'm seeing too in ag, is there's more female operators. There's more female producers that are really tied into the operation, and they're not necessarily like my wife that's baking and cooking every little thing. You know, they have more of shared roles within their operation. I'd say my situation is we're very much traditional, but that's not where we rest on, you know, fully. It's just we've got,
well, you've got young kids, right?
Yeah, and it's for being the oldest first-time dad in Nebraska, you know, I had to I had to learn how to do laundry. I, you know, when you're a bachelor as long as I was, you're either a slob or you're not. And so I wasn't a slob. So, you know, back in the day when you used to starch your jeans and have a crease and all that stuff, man, I was the king of the ironing board, you know, but now I don't have to play those games, thankfully. And we've got a very traditional home style, but I know how to throw dishes in the dishwasher for better or worse. So,
yeah, my wife has the same role, it seems like, as your wife. She's the homemaker and
right,
takes care of the kids, because she's actually pregnant with our fourth, my fifth child. So,
oh wow, yeah,
five technically. Wow.
She's, well, how old's your oldest now?
21.
Jeez. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I became a father at 19, right?
Right, so, right.
Teenage dad, and had to just, you know, that matured me really quick. You know, I slowed down a lot of my, I would probably be dead if he wasn't alive, because I was really, really balls to the wall in the wrong direction, you know, just
trying to
do everything all the time and partying.
Right.
You know, not all destructive stuff, but just,
right,
you know, like I was a high energy, I'm a high energy guy. And so I like to be busy and so on. And so I'd just be, you know, always wanted to be busy, always had these large goals and stuff like that, you know? So he matured me really quick, you know, at 19, becoming a father, just crazy.
Is he active with the farm operation today or?
No. He's been off and on, like he's helped off and on, but there's a point, and I think every farmer can relate to, where the kid, the next generation, actually appreciates the opportunity that they're given.
Mm-hmm.
If you get them in too early, they either have an entitlement mentality, or they just don't appreciate it and they're late for work or
right.
or all this other BS, you know, mm-hmm. like they're pain in the ass basically at the end
of
the
day. Oh yeah, for sure.
Yep. Yeah. And so he's not to the point where he's like, I want to carry the torch, you know, mm-hmm. and I wasn't either. I was a pain in the ass for my dad too. Cause I did,
right.
you know, I kind of had I went to New York and did banking after college.
Okay. Right?
So putting on a suit every day and then coming back to the farm and driving a truck was a pretty challenging transition for me mentally.
Well, you probably messed up your manicure trying to shift, you know, being with city people out of New York. I know how those guys are. And it's just, you know, and for me, it was very similar because around here, there's not that many farmers that are in their 40s, for example.
Yeah.
Most of them are like my wife's age. They're in their early 30s. They probably graduated high school with $7 corn. You know, there was a lot of positives to stick around the operation. I graduated high school in 2000, you know, and I had several opportunities to do different things out of state. And my dad was just always a straight shooter and said, look, I just don't know if there's any room in our little operation. We're not large farmers at all. And, you know, he had to do different things. I mean, he was farrow to finish on at least 100 sows. Livestock was always a part of my family's operation up until now. And I'm grateful that we don't have to play livestock games because it really is a lot of work. And hats off to anybody that's, you know, running pairs or has a small feed yard. Or there's not many guys farrowing anymore. I think it's more so just receiving feeder pigs and, you know, doing those types of games. There's some larger hatcheries in Nebraska. And, you know, back to the hens, I mean, that's an operation. You got 100,000 layers. And, you know, just the automation is really impressive. But yeah, I graduated high school, corn and beans it was painful. And so I disappeared for a while.
Yeah.
And about 13 years later, I was able to move back home. And I went off into the oil and gas industry. So I was doing well valuations, different due diligence projects. I didn't have any experience. I didn't know anything. You know, a lot of my life was I maybe got one job my whole life on my own without knowing anybody, and everything else it just fell in my lap because a buddy said, hey, come over here. And that's basically my whole story, you know. And I met with one of those hedge fund groups that you referred, and they said, well, you need to have a family motto. And I think I responded right away, well, yeah, I already do. And our motto is hard work and dumb luck. And that's really been the story of my life. We probably worked a little bit harder and made some other sacrifices, but you know, potentially because of that, a lot of good things happened. And it's very cliche. Half the things in my life are just old, outdated, antiquated things that coaches would have said. And, you know, my old basketball coach in high school said, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you get. And those shots that wouldn't go down for the average guy, they seem to go down for you because you put in the effort.
Yeah.
And so that's a lot of it is just, yeah, hard work, dumb luck. But by the time I came back to the farm, 13, you know, started off a decent year for at least for corn and beans. And then things really started to change throughout that growing season. And then by 14, we were back in, you know, basically a 7-year struggle.
Yes.
And so basically my first full season back in the game in 14 as an adult, you know, there really wasn't a lot to be positive about.
No, 14. That's when I started Cash Cow Farmer because we came off of the 12, 13. Just bull Super Bowl market.
Right.
And then everything just collapsed and fell apart, just like it did in 2024 and 5, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's just, it's different. You know, you got to get lucky sometimes. And it's just so many things working against producers. And then we're not in control of our destiny to boot. You know, and you explain to your buddies in New York City with the manicures, you know, how we produce and what we do as producers, but then we can't name our pricing and we're at the mercy of the markets and everything else that goes along with it. And it's just, unfortunately right now, everybody is so negative in agriculture. And I understand if I was only farming and I'm great at losing money as a farmer, I don't know how I'd have a future. And honestly, it's just, it's a tough game to play. And it's not a timely thing. It's always been that way.
Yeah. It's such a ebb and flow market. I mean, with the commodity prices being break even for out of a 10-year cycle, there's one great year. There's two okay years. There's, and then the rest of the well, maybe there's three okay years, and then there's 6 years that are pretty tough.
Yeah.
And the 6 years usually come consecutively or almost consecutively.
Yeah.
That's what makes it really tough, is you have to have off-farm income, or you have to be very efficient on your farm. And that's why, you know, I think the problem is guys are no longer have diversity. They have corn, beans. They don't have small grains anymore. They right. don't have hay ground. They don't have animals anymore. Because our revenue on cattle was, I mean, that was great having that, you know, out of our 156 head herd, I sold 8 opens and 150, 140 some calves. And that brought in like almost $400,000 in revenue to the farm. Right.
Yeah.
You know, off of 150 something cow operation. Obviously we have expenses for that and all this other stuff. Oh, but when you're a grain farmer, you have really busy days and then you have weeks of not very busy. And I have full-time guys year round.
Right.
And so I'm like, well, now my guys have something to do, because I get a lot of H2A workers on my farm.
Oh, I see.
Almost all my labor on my farm is South African or Brazilian because my wife's from Brazil.
And oh, so wow.
we end up with this for harvest. We had 5 Brazilians on the farm. Wow. My father-in-law, my brother-in-law, a couple, a boyfriend and girlfriend that had helped us. They live in the south of Brazil. And it was so funny. This Brazilian, they live in the south of Brazil, so they have 3 harvests every year.
Okay.
And we have obviously 1 harvest.
Right, right.
And I'm getting in the combine. We're doing beans. And I'm like trying to remember how to set this up. I'm like, gosh, what's the concave sieve settings? Like, I'm scratching my head and looking in the back. And I'm like, hey, you know, there's crap in the tank. What do I need to adjust? And
right.
Ricardo comes in. And I'm like, ride with me for a while. I'm like, you know, he's like looking around and he's kind of like, oh, maybe you should do this. And I'm like, maybe you should drive. And so I put him in the driver's seat and I was like, Ricardo, when was the last time you ran a combine? And he's like, oh, 2 weeks ago. Yeah. And I'm like, I'm like, all right, you found yourself. This is what you're going to do.
It's always a battle. I mean, we've got that little card from John Deere. And then every year we start off doing the same thing. My dad's in the seat. I'm holding the little card and so, you know, maybe speed the fan up a little bit. It looks like we got a little bit of range and we don't have any automation. And I think that's what we need, because we make those adjustments in our old 70 series and everything's great for about 5 or 10 acres. And then everything changes again. And not to slander Deer, but God dang, that thing just seeds corn out of the back. I don't understand. I can never get those adjustments perfect. And are you guys running Deer combines?
Yeah. We're running Deer.
Yeah. Are you up to the X series, or are you just on the?
Yeah, we've been running X for 2 years now.
Oh, okay, cool.
And the grain is so clean coming out.
Is it really?
Yeah. Even, we had a tough year this year based off of our excess moisture. So we had way too much rain and flooded crops, and so we had our dryland yields are usually around 185 average on about 4,000 to 5,000 acres of corn. That's an average. Wow. So that's the good and the bad in there. So it's pretty good. We got some fields that are average over 200 and some that are, you know, mid to low 100s, but average is 185. So our average this year was probably 130 maybe on the farm. Damn. So we were extremely poor averages. Mm-hmm. So what we did is, you know, we almost had the stick on the X9 going all the way the whole time.
Wow.
Just to keep it full, because if you don't keep your rotor full,
you're
not using the crop to separate the
from the chat. Yeah.
You're not using the crop against itself. It's just, there's too much space inside the concaves and stuff. And so, we were harvesting most of the corn at, you know, 6, 7, 8 miles an hour.
So now is that a 40 foot head, or how big of a corn header do you run?
No, I wish I could run the 16 row, but we have a 24 row planter, so we can't.
Right. So you're still sticking 12.
Yeah. Yeah. We're running 12. We're running chopping, you know, so that's using the horse.
Takes some power.
A track machine. So that's using some horse, but still that X9 has so much capacity. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
You know, we never got it into the red bar, I don't think, at all during harvest.
It's interesting around here. You'll see a lot of guys that are, and it doesn't seem to matter. You know, we're pretty flat, you know, in theory. There's, again, you know, Nebraska, it's not for everybody. They stuck the interstate where everything's really flat. but you can go 20, 30 miles in any direction. You can get into some pretty challenging terrain, surprisingly. So there's a little bit of a need for some operations to have the side hill package and, you know, things like that. But in general anymore, you know, it's like that row of shame always pops up no matter what we do. And I don't think it really matters. Well, you never heard of the row of shame?
No, I haven't.
Oh man, we even got a song on Tuesday Radio about it. It's awesome. But when you're basically finishing up and then you randomly just have one random row, you know, sticking out like it, that's called the row of shame. So we've got a lot of random expressions here we'll pass on
to you. That's what the grain cart operator is supposed to do, is just nudge over and and run over the row of shame. You got some pheasant.
Well, but for a cattle guy, yeah, I mean, it's, that's what you guys would do. But, you know, down here, there's not a lot of cattle guys left. So then you got to go back and, you know, maybe put it in the middle of your head and then, you know, cut it down. But so the row of shame always seems to come up. And what I'm getting at is I plant 16, you know, RTK, and then I've got the cell phone correction. My guest rows are perfect. Mm-hmm. And really, it doesn't seem to matter. I feel like I could run a 12 row head on a 16 row planter and not have an issue anymore.
How would you do the headlands though?
Well, it just, you'd have some overlap or some dead space.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's just, you wouldn't be able to cut everything out evenly. You'd just come back and maybe I'd plant them instead of just 40 foot on the headlands. Maybe I'd do something different, you know, but I'm only picking 8 and I'm planting 16. It seems like a lot of guys are planting 16 and picking 12 in my area. So it's just, they needed the extra capacity. They've got the help. They can run 2 grain carts. Now that's our thing in Nebraska. They're called auger wagons. So I'm assuming you're from grain cart country from how they say it. It's almost like pop and soda. You know, I'm from, and I don't know about the Dakotas, but I'm assuming you guys say pop.
Yeah, we say pop.
Okay. I think the only auger wagon state there is Nebraska. I think everybody else probably says it correctly and says grain cart. So I'm such a sellout now. I find myself saying fancy things like grain cart, you know, and then people around here just kind of look at me like, what are you talking about, grain cart? You know, and I've always pronounced fungicide like fungicide. I'm the only one in Nebraska that does that apparently. And I've got a lot of customers and friends and stuff in Iowa. So I copy the Iowa farmers because they almost look like politicians. They don't necessarily look like farmers. They're so, you know, well-dressed and, you know, they're like Anderson over there.
No pun intended. Yeah. So why don't you get a 24 row planter?
There's no need for me. I mean, my 16 high speed and I'm tiny. I mean, I only did like 600 and some odd acres this year. So it's just,
is there a big price difference?
Not really. And it's just, you know, I'm in mounted country. Very few people run pole type planters in my neck of the woods. And it's just, there's even guys with 24 row mounted planters.
Yeah.
And, you know, fully mounted. It's a ton of weight, obviously. And I've got a friend that's pretty big, or at least he used to be in the seed corn. And he's got a really sweet mounted setup where it's 20 row is the main. And then he's got tips that he can bolt on that fold back in, and then he can do 24 when he does his commercial. But it's all fully mounted. It's just with all the pivots and different irrigation systems, maybe I could swing it, but I mean, really the largest thing I run off of a draw bar is, you know, probably like a 25 foot disc, you know? So, I mean, for me to even turn around with something like that, I'd hide your mailbox pretty quick because I'd probably hit the damn thing. But no, it's pretty standard in my neck of the woods. It's a similar setup to maybe more so cotton country, you know, down south. Just a lot of guys are mounted for convenience, and it doesn't seem to really affect us negatively. And then we used to always be what we would call flood or gravity irrigation. So then you wouldn't have any headland, and you would basically just lay pipe at the top of the field and then run the water down every row. Mm. So that's where this all probably came from.
But, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I like the idea of a larger planter, but I mean, really, I could get by with a 4-row planter and probably 2.5 mules, and I could get it done pretty quick. So it's just, you know, what I'm doing, I've got machinery. We used to farm a significant amount more, but basically just given up everything that we rent. And for better or worse, at least I didn't lose as much money as I could have this year. I could have lost a heck of a lot more at $350 to $400 cash rent. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. The cash rents are out of control. It's just insane.
But so are the land prices, you know. And I'm not really confident in what's going on with even real estate. I don't quite understand. There just yesterday, not to be too timely, but there was two gravity irrigated 80s in an area where there's water restriction at 13 inches a year. Honestly, with gravity on a semi-dry year, you need about 20 inches of water. And these, you know, so gravity 80s, you're not thinking these would be anything to talk about. They brought 9,900 an acre yesterday. And it's, you know, and it's south far enough where it's significantly drier.
Farmer bought or investor bought?
I'm assuming farmer, but I guess I don't know. I just was watching remotely. But yeah, it's just there's still strong prices, but I guess maybe that's more of a reflection of everything else. It's just really everything is expensive except used equipment.
Well, generally you have pretty good prices in bad years because there's so little volume of land for changing hands.
Right.
In good years, a lot of people are in the same mentality that, hey, let's sell a little bit of land. You know, for those people that have land they want to sell, they usually wait till prices are good. And then what happens is there's more sales volume, which actually decreases the price.
Yeah.
So in bad years, the market generally, when in bad commodity cycles, generally speaking, the market price of land is higher.
Yeah. And I've never really done the deep dive, but there's been some, you know, really big headlines on these auctions recently, this late fall and into winter. But I just don't really understand. And but again, I'm not here to understand everything. I'm just looking at what people are presenting. There is a lot of land volume coming on the market, though. And I think I did read a headline that was quite shocking, even for Iowa. There just seems to be a lot of land coming on the market. You know, here in my part of Nebraska, there's a ton of organic farmers that, you know, for better or worse, went under. And some of those producers are putting a lot of that real estate on the market. And I think it's going to change. And unfortunately, if you're in a position to buy, I would just be afraid that, you know, we might be repeating in a different fashion, you know, maybe that early to mid 80s transition where, you know, next thing you know, it's down 40-50%. I don't really see that happening. You know, I don't know. I don't really know anything. I'm just trying not to go broke.
Yeah.
That's what the show ought to be called. Stay out of bankruptcy after Tuesday. I don't know.
Yeah. I don't know. It's definitely an interesting deal, you know. But what happens is when you have large volumes of land come on for sale and low commodity prices, you have good buying opportunities.
Yeah.
So I think the one thing that is different from the 80s as for to today is the interest rates, and they're trying to push those even lower now. The interest rates come down a lot from last year.
Yeah.
You know, like 8% was a pretty common, 7-8% was pretty common last 2 years. And now I'm seeing loan rates in the fives.
Yeah.
And teaser commercial loan rates in the threes, you know. Mm. So that's not gonna fuel depreciated prices with that interest rates. When you had 17 or 19% interest rates in the 80s, that was what really, I think, broke. And then, so, you know, one thing, the interest rate is so powerful. People don't understand. We did I've invested in some multifamily deals, and we have like 3 to 5 year rate locks that we buy from the bank.
Okay.
Well, I invested in a large multifamily complex in Phoenix with a company called Rise 48 that does tons of these deals. Like every month we buy $100 million worth of multifamily, almost. Like they're huge. They're juggernauts.
Okay.
But not all their deals worked out. So our interest rate lock from 3 years ago reset this summer when interest rates were not very good.
Yeah.
And if we would have not bought another interest rate lock, the whole thing would have been bankrupt.
Yeah.
That's what the guy at Rise told me. The top guy, he said, what happens with when you have this much, when our interest rate goes from 3% to 7% or 9%, whatever it was for the commercial volumes that size. Plus, it's the value of the real estate has depreciated because interest rates went up. So you not only have a slight depreciation in loan to value, but you have higher monthly or the higher payments from the interest rate resetting. So the whole thing was like, he said, we have to do a capital call, which means you had to put in 50% of what you invested originally in the deal, or you would be so far down the capital stack in the deal when it sold or changed hands that you wouldn't get your money back.
Jeez.
And so he said you had to put in 50%, and then that would allow them to buy another interest rate lock. Otherwise, they would have to file for bankruptcy in that entity that owns that asset. You know, every single deal, I mean, they do a deal every month, right? So every deal is a completely separate deal. It's just they're the management company, like Trump. You know, Trump can do a property that goes bankrupt, but he's the management company. So that property, even though it may have Trump's branding on it, went bankrupt, but he's the property manager. So it's a completely different.
So I, you know, as far as being a farmer and for any potential side quests or investment, what would you have confidence in right now? Because I think, you know, and I don't want to make it too public, but kind of my situation and, you know, what's happening, what is a safe haven in theory? If it's not buying more productive farmland, what's out there for the average guy that, you know, hey, I might have an extra $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 sitting around. What's a stable move?
Yeah, that's the zillion dollar question, right? It depends on the volume, first of all. You know, if you have an extra $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, your options are much more limited than if you had an extra $500,000 or $1 million. So I invest in, I have two different hedge funds that I'm a partner with. And so I have options. The nice thing about that is, unlike a real estate deal, you can get your money out if you need it. They usually have a 30-day lockup or something where you just have to let them know within 30 days that, hey, I need to pull some capital out because I have an opportunity, you know, a rare opportunity on the farm to acquire an asset or to upgrade or to do whatever. So that's what I do, is I stick as much of my liquid capital. I never sit on cash. I put it in the hedge fund because they're going to make me 8-ish% a year, which is the bank will never pay 8% a year. Even if you throw in a CD, best rates I seen in a CD last year were like 4.75 in a CD. And you had to do a 3-month lock for that, which was not bad, right? You know, but 3 months, then the next 3 months, it was like, oh, it's only 4.6. And then now it's down to like 4.2 or something like that. So I put it in the fund. And if I need it back, I take it back. But I'm getting 8% on that money and it's liquid. And, you know, because if you're going to throw your money in a Schwab account or name your little personal stock trader account, you're just, unless you're diligently watching, you can't be a part-time farmer and do well.
Right.
You can't be a part-time investor and do well.
Right.
The one day that you want to, that you and your wife are in Cancun and you're like, yeah, I'm not going to check the markets today, all hell breaks loose.
Right.
And you lost the last 6 months worth of diligent investing.
Exactly.
So unless it's your day job, don't put your capital, you know, like, don't do it. Hire somebody that has a track record of doing that well as their day job, which is why I do the hedge fund stuff. You know, but there's minimums. Like, that's where it comes back to the dollar amount. There's minimums that you can put into a hedge fund because a hedge fund doesn't want, you know, there's a limited number of investors that a hedge fund can take depending on the tier. There's two tiers. There's one that I think they can have 200 limited partners. And then, but that's a lot less regulatory oversight and reporting that they have to do, the agencies, you know, that let's say that costs $100,000 a year in regulation. You can have 200 limited partners. And then the next tier is like $1 million in regulatory oversight. Compliance crap that you have to deal with, but that's unlimited. But you first need to get, you know, a pretty good amount of capital under your management, where your fees and your performance fees and your regular fees are going to pay, you know, significantly more money. So you got to have probably $100 million under management before you even consider moving to the second tier.
Right.
But if you have 200 people at $50,000, you're only at 10 million.
Right, exactly.
So you have to limit the, you have to set a floor on what you're willing to take. So most of the hedge funds have like $100,000 or $1 million floor where they're like, right. Hey, we'll take $1 million. So that's what he's one of my mentors, actually, Sanjay Gupta of Britannica right. Capital. And he, his minimum was $1 million. So I remember I was like, man, when he first came out, it took me a couple of years before I could leverage and save $1 million in cash to wire him $1 million.
Wow.
And so during, and it just, everything worked out. I saved money, sold some stuff. And then I had an opportunity to take some equity out of farmland.
Okay.
So I did a reverse mortgage on like 290 acres. And I stuck that. That was when interest rates were like low threes.
Yeah.
So I borrowed like $500,000 at the low threes in like the early, when was that? 2000? Before COVID. When
was okay.
That? When the interest rates were good. I can't.
Yeah, they were good for a while there. I think, and that kind of spoiled a lot of people. You know, interest was very cheap. Cash theory was cheap. And now we've turned into this time where cash again is king. And yeah, interest rates ticked up a bit. And then now, like you said, I think the prime rate probably for a mortgage is around 6.5 again. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, when I bought a house about a year and a half ago, about a year and a half ago, it was right around 8% was pretty common, you know, and it's just that makes a big difference for the average person. Their bottom line from 3 points to 8 points. Yeah, that extra 5% really balloons up those payments. And it's a difficult time. You know, unfortunately, a lot of farmers don't have, you know, $500,000 or $1 million cash sitting around. But I think more producers are interested in getting creative.
You do, but you don't. And that's the thing about, you have to be creative with your capital. Mm-hmm. Chances are you have either assets you're not using, right. assets you're not monetizing, or equity that you're not capitalizing on.
Right.
You know, like if you own 2/4 of farmland, which is, you know, 320 acres, and that farmland is worth probably $1 million a quarter in almost any market or more. Maybe in your market, it's worth $1.5 million, right?
Probably so.
And you basically have $2 million in equity. You can go to Farm Credit Services or any bank. Any bank will give you 50% loan to value ratio.
Okay.
Like this, right? So within 30 days, you can have $1 million in cash if you have two quarters of farmland free and clear, right?
Right.
Yeah. But you can't take $1 million in cash out, pay 6% on it, and stick it into an investment that's risky, like crypto or something like that.
Right.
You know, you have to find something. So the way I did it, I took out $500,000 in debt at 3%, stuck it into the hedge fund, which the first year did like 13%. Jeez. But you got to remember, you're not just paying interest back on your land, right? On your land loan, you're paying interest and principal every year. Right. So if you borrow money at 6% and you're getting 8%, your delta there is pretty tight. So your cash flow is going to be negative on that investment because you're paying down principal and interest
as well.
Just interest appreciation, you know? So it's a way to like make a big investment today, but pay for it over time. It's like you're setting up your own pension by doing that. You have to put your equity to work. So more than likely, you know, people say I've only got $10,000 in cash in the bank, but chances are they have some equity that they're not using, inefficient assets that they either need to auction on Tractor Tuesday and get rid of and turn to cash, or they need to put to work, rent out, you know, start utilizing. You know, if you've got an excavator that you put on 50 hours a week, Joe Salatin says, if you don't put 250 hours a year on an asset, you shouldn't own it.
Right.
And that's kind of a general rule of thumb. If you put 150 hours on your planter tractor and your planter every year, it's probably worth owning for that because it's so critical. The time.
Right, right.
Everything else. You can't just rent a planter because by the time everybody's done and you have one to rent, it's too late.
Yeah, it's too late. Yeah.
So, but yeah, general rule of thumb, like if you're efficient with your assets and your equity that's available on your balance sheet, you can turn that into residual income that's going to support you in these tougher years.
So what Scott was just saying now is I shouldn't own a combine. My 94 separator hours this year probably wasn't worth it, but you know, it's my dad got that, and we're a different type of operation. And my dad has had 3 combines in 45 years. So we basically average about 15 years, we get a new machine. So I inherited our little 9570, and it works all right for what we're doing. But I know you're right. There's a lot of truth to that. And I think even our banker, who I would consider a friend, a great guy, he's kind of advanced with the group that he's with and is no longer a personal banker, if you will. You know, but he used to kind of poke at my dad a little bit, but there was some good truth there. It's just, you know, when you're small enough like we are, I don't know, just those, the cost of those separator hours, you really can't justify owning a combine anymore.
Well, if you didn't have Tractor Tuesday, mm-hmm. and you had basically the whole fall to harvest, right. There's probably 5 or 10 neighbor farmers that are for small, sure. that you could say, hey, you know, I know custom combining rates are 48 an acre and 15 cents a bushel to haul. So, right. Hey, I could do it for 40. I'm just trying to get more combine, more. They're saving money. You're making your payments. You're keeping your crew busy, you know, or you and you're keeping yourself busy. So yes, if you can pick up some contract work, you can make some payments and make a few bucks on the side. That's why there's like all these little tactics you got to do and analyze your operation and say, hey, where can I be more efficient? Where can I add hours? You know, pick up some contract work, because by the time you've done your own farm, you remember how to run your combine, right, and you're going to do a good job for a few of the neighbors. You'll
do better for the neighbor, yeah.
Or you're like right across the road from your neighbor, and it's like, man, let me just jump the road and harvest that for him,
right?
Make a few bucks, and then like as you work your way across your operation, you're picking the neighbor's crop and taking it to town, and it's just it's a great way to put extra money in your pocket. I know a lot of neighbors that do a lot of that contract sort of work.
Well, and that's what we've been doing. Is a good friend of mine, everybody in Nebraska is related if you're from Germany, whether you want to admit it or not, but kind of a distant relative. And long story short, they are too precise, too accurate, but they've been cutting our beans for a few years now. And, you know, and I used to help, and I'd run the auger wagon while they're running their new 780 and their nice HydraFlex and all the cool stuff they've got. And it's like, God dang, just pick up the head and turn around, like quit trying to cut every inch of my messed up field here, you know? And so it's great having neighbors and friends like that, but you know, it's worth what you get. And the problem is when you are a small operator like myself, I mean, honestly, this year, my loss was my insurance premium, basically. If it wasn't for crop insurance, I would have been pretty darn close to break even. And that's with a couple major breakdowns that I had to pay for on our machinery. But that's the problem. One significant breakdown anymore, as tight as these margins are, even with minimal rent, you know, Nebraska, we've got a major problem with property taxes. They say Missouri, their slogan, they're the show me state. Nebraska is the tax me state. So we pay our share. And yeah, one major breakdown, and especially with a combine, that can get pretty costly. I mean, you can really blow $15,000 to $30,000 pretty darn quick on this modern machinery. Even just a simple clutch in our C8R Cornhead, I think that was a few thousand dollars for the mechanic to show up. And I mean, in theory, we could have worked on that ourselves. But if you've ever replaced a clutch on a Cornhead, you know, there's a lot to get to first before you get to that clutch. You know, and sometimes these mechanics, even though their service call could be $250 an hour, something that takes them 2 hours would have taken me 6, and I might be missing a piece of my finger if I did it myself. So sometimes it's worth just paying the piper for efficiency. But
so next to your gun safe, you need another safe with just your John Deere spare parts, because they're actually worth more than your guns.
Right. Oh yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it's, and we don't have much green. That's about it. Is you know, our 70 series and then our Cornhead. Man, I can't get out of there with a bag of bolts for under $100. And I'm not talking about a dozen bolts. I'm talking about 3 or 4 and a locking nut.
Yes. So here's something. Is the train coming by?
Oh, and everybody's going to know how cheap my rent is. I'm right on top of the train tracks here. So hopefully Kyle, the producer, can edit that down a little bit. But
I
yeah.
grew up next to train tracks. And when I went to college in Lincoln, Nebraska, right next to the train tracks, I couldn't even hear them because I grew up next to tracks. That there'd be college kids shouting out the window, "F you, train."
Oh, yeah.
I didn't even notice the train was coming by because it just, you come deaf to it.
Well, and in the middle of nowhere, if you don't live by the rail, you know, where are you? You know, because it's just, it's about as much as pipelines. They're in everybody's field, you know, and it's just the same thing with the rail system. So
yeah, hey, one thing that farmers can utilize, ChatGPT, right? If you're farming and you're not using ChatGPT, you really should utilize that. It's way more efficient to find parts, to find, you know, how to's. If you have an error code that pops up on your John Deere screen, right, take a picture, put it in ChatGPT, and it'll walk you through. It's like having, you know, the John Deere service manager on your cell phone. It's insane how quickly you can diagnose problems, find fuses, whatever you got to do with ChatGPT. And what I've been doing, I sold a tractor to a neighbor, a loader tractor. And he needed, so it's cold in South Dakota right now, obviously. Mm-hmm. So he needed the cord to plug into the heater that plugs it into the wall, the engine block heater.
Yeah.
And I didn't have it because I had bought that tractor also used. So somewhere it disappeared.
Okay.
And so he's like, "It's $450. He's like, "Are you sure you don't have that cord?" I'm like, "Yeah, I don't have it." And so you look on eBay, you look on salvage places, and you can find it for like $125
to $150. Right,
right. Right. So it's like most people, I mean, I can tell if you're harvesting, something breaks, you got to go to the store now to get rolling, get wheels rolling again. That's one thing. But if it's wintertime and you're like, "Oh man, this is broken. This is broken. We got to fix the belt and all this other stuff." Use the technology that we have now to figure out where the salvage, I mean, there's probably 10 salvage yards in the United States that you could just phone call to look up a part number. They may not have, like, ChatGPT may not be able to search their website, or you might be able to go to their website and search manually, but it can at least pull up a list of the salvage yards, and you're going to save so much money on parts.
Well, and we ought to get them on the show, but man, Abilene Machine, and I think they have one now, a location maybe up in your neck of the woods. I know they're out of, it's actually not even Abilene, Kansas. I've been down there. It's the next town adjacent, but man, they're phenomenal. And they have so many parts available. They're probably, if they're not the king of the salvage game, they're right there. And, you know, I've bought tractors out east where they don't have a lot of weights up front. You know, a lot of times they might just have kind of a rock box or something like that. And, even on suitcase weights and rear wheel weights, I mean, I've paid basically 40 cents on the dollar through Abilene Machine just getting weights. And there's a lot of advantages there. And then, you know, we've got all these pivots around. And my dad was turning the combine a couple of years ago and, you know, just clipped the back of the combine a little bit on some of that poly. And, you know, geez, going through deer, it would have been probably $20,000 to repair those pieces, and it didn't affect anything on the assembly of it all. But again, through Abilene Machine, for example, I think we were able to get those replacement pieces. I mean, it was a lot of iron too underneath that poly, but about $4,500. You know, I mean, you could basically get it used from salvage and save a pretty penny. So, but again, yeah, AI is a huge tool, and we should probably do an episode about that to some degree, because
we should.
Not to scare everybody, but at Tractor Tuesday, we had our own proprietary AI. We still work with some of these large language models. Again, my guy is just well-versed in a lot of different things on our little development team. But, you know, when people knew I was getting into that in 2024, you know, they'd look at me, you know, a lot of conspiratorial friends, and I may try to add to those conversations. But, you know, they were assuming that it was like the Terminator scene where the cop melts through the wall and then he's going to kill everybody. I thought, "Oh man, you guys are ridiculous." But then I'll tell you, about a year into it, I thought, "Oh my goodness, the Terminator is going to melt through the wall and kill everybody." Yeah. It's just, it's so powerful. It's just, it's amazing what some of those tools can do, but it's going to be just like the T9 calculator. You know, it's just, it's always going to be a part of your life. You know, and who would have thought these cell phones would have this type of power when, you know, mom and dad were cruising around in their minivan in the 90s with a bag phone? Not my family, because I didn't grow up like that, but, you know, other friends that, you know, from that to what we have in our pocket today. And I think we're going to look back in 20 years and, you know, AI will be so much a part of our lives that you won't even think about it. You know, it's just part of your day to day. And it may be more of an automated process that you don't even realize is happening. It's just your decisions are always made by that artificial intelligence, if you will.
Yeah. So out here in California, for the last year, when we were out here last year, I would go to LA to some of these business masterminds, and they've, for over a year, they've had these WeMo driverless taxis.
Yeah.
Little, I think they're made by Jaguar, and they've got little spinning cameras and little spinning. I mean, there's a lot of tech on the outside of the car, but there's nobody in, nobody's driving.
Right.
Yeah. It's crazy. So you get in the WeMo, you put, just like Uber, you put where you want to go, where you're picked up, you get in and they take you to where you're going, and they have, they're better drivers than we are. And they'll do all the same, you know, kind of, they'll do the same stuff. So I was following one of these things last year, and red light, pedestrians, traffic, we're in LA, and it stopped at the red light. It needed to turn right, blinker on, wait for the pedestrians, you know, okay, no traffic. It made a right on, a safe right on red with pedestrian foot traffic. Mm. Well, no problem. The computer did.
So I had a contract in oil and gas. I was in LA County for like 3 or 4 months. And, you know, does it know how to hit the blinker at the last minute and then merge? Because well, that's the secret to LA County. And thankfully, I didn't have to travel that far. I would go down Sepulveda, you know, kind of close to LAX. And I was closer to Hermosa Beach Pier, but Redondo Beach. And that was the secret to driving out there. You couldn't signal. You signal? Oh, man. You're just a lame duck and you'll never get over. So it'd be interesting to see how that evolves and if it can honk its horn, because that's kind of a crucial thing. I think in LA County, they replace horns and automobiles, if not annually, about every 2 years, because they're shot, man. But I don't understand. And, you know, and then you go to like Vail or Beaver Creek and those areas in Colorado, and everybody you meet is just the nicest people on earth. But then you're on the interstate with these people. And it's not a Midwestern mentality on the interstates and in these larger areas, Colorado, California. It's a nightmare, man. People are just, I don't know what to say about it, but I'm surprised the automated cars work so well, because it just seems like there's nothing predictable with the traffic patterns and the way people drive. They're so aggressive out there. But
yeah. And once they perfect the software and the sensor system, it'll be retrofit on whatever car you want. If you're driving a 2010, you know, GMC 1500, you can buy a retrofit kit. I'm sure that they'll have like mountable cameras and technology you can put in your car and have it driverless.
Okay. You know?
Like it's crazy. Like, and then anything new is coming out with that. You know, I have a buddy here that just bought a new Escalade, and it has like the super cruise mode where it pretty much drives itself. We've had a Tesla since 2000, a Model X Tesla since 2000. And I think mine is a 2020, but it was maybe 1 or 2 years old when I bought it. I bought it in like 21 or 22. Cause we do a lot of just empty miles on the farm. It's like, there's no traffic. I'm like, man, I just would like to put the cruise on and text and do all the other crap that I got to do while driving.
Right.
You know, and have the car just drive me to work. And so the Teslas, you know, like there's a package that I can buy, which is pretty cheap. I want to say it's like $4,000 or $5,000. It'll upgrade the cameras and make it driverless. So I don't even have to like jerk the steering wheel. Cause with the Tesla, you have to either have pressure or you have to jerk the steering wheel every few minutes, or it'll kick you out of self-driving mode.
I see.
And you'll be back, right back onto just cruise control.
And you can do that on gravel roads too.
I mean, I have blacktop from my farm to the other farm that I drive every day, which is 100 miles round trip.
Oh man.
But I don't know if I've tried it on the gravel. I think it would work on gravel because there's a clear line between gravel and grass.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
I just don't think it'd work in Adams County. We've no offense to the county roads here, but man, they are awful. And it makes you wonder what the $80 per acre property taxes are for.
$80 an acre?
Oh, I don't even want to talk about it. Whoa. I think we're between, and it depends. There's some variance between different school districts, but probably $64 to $81 an acre, roughly. And
where's all that? What do they do with all that money?
Just ask the cool kids in Omaha and Lincoln what they'd do with it. I don't know. You know, I mean, it's just not to get too political, but we've got a lot of issues here in Nebraska. And I think we in the rural part that nobody out east wants to recognize is, what we're supporting here with a lot of our cash. So, but we've got some great public schools in theory. And we've even got more of a farmer style public school that's in the middle of the county where I'm at. They do a great job for being a public school. It's got kind of a feel of a private school. You know, they had an interesting situation, and I shouldn't say too much, but they know how to basically squash or eliminate before it's a problem. And I think they do a good job of that, thankfully, there. But, you know, we're leaning more towards a private school opportunity for our children. So we've got number three coming in the middle of January as well. So we're adding to the family, and I'll be 50 probably by the time I'm done having children. So
me too. And I'm 40, so I got 10 more years of baby making. And my wife's not much younger than me. So,
oh, really? Wow.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, we'll see. Eventually.
Is there a goal? Is there an end number here? Or are you just letting it wing?
When my wife can't do it anymore, that's when I'm going to quit.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's a lot of fun. And I think
getting better with every baby, though.
Well, and you know, not that I was ever a bad dad, but you know, it's almost like anything you have to understand and get into the rhythm of things, you know, and I really enjoy even the bedtime routine and all the things that go with it. So it's a lot of fun. And I think we're going to miss the baby stage. And I think that's going to probably lead us into maybe five
or six. But then we'll be in the grandparent stage, right? If we go long enough, we'll have a few years of no babies, but then it'll be grandkids. I'm like, all right,
That's the thing. I don't know how I've evolved and changed the family. You know, I've come from a long line of unemotional Germans, and you know, I think I've got more parenting skills maybe than any of the other males in my ancestry. So I'm a little bit more hands on, I think. You know, I don't know if my dad ever changed a diaper, but
yeah. We're homeschooling our kids. We do diaper-free baby stuff. So we do elimination communication, which I think everybody should look into because it's so easy to do. You literally just have to give your children the opportunity to sit on a potty and go to the bathroom.
Exactly.
And they will. Yeah, not every time, but most of the time. And there's usually a routine. Baby wakes up. Baby can't sleep. She's fussy. You know, she might be a little gassy. Like most parents know when their baby's shitting. And so you just say, oh, baby's got to go to the bathroom. To the bathroom. Drop. Yeah. You get quick release, like snaps. You just like, and then flip the diaper off, put them on the potty, or you hold them in a certain way when they're small, and they just blast off. And it completely eliminates them. So there's no diaper rash. There's none of these other issues.
Well, and it's unfortunate. So many kids, they just walk around with a soiled diaper, you know, and and then you're seeing around here, my neck of the woods, there's like 4-year-olds wearing diapers, you know, that still have pacifiers, you know, or begging for, it's like, oh my goodness, you know, and not to be this hardcore parent, it might be a good conversation in a future episode, but you know, our 18 to 19 month old daughter at the time literally potty trained herself. I mean, there really was nothing to it. And my wife had our son potty trained at 19 months, and that was a nightmare. I mean, it took, I think she knows the exact number of days it took to break him. And it was about 17 or 18 days. Maybe it was more than that, but just letting him walk around naked. And, you know, trying to get those cues, throw them on the toilet. We had little potties everywhere.
Yes.
My daughter didn't need any of that. She just kind of witnessed what was going on around us. And we'd never even had to modify the toilet for her. She'd just climb up there and, you know, and maybe it could be said my kids are giants, but she was able to just get on the toilet and do her thing. And, you know, she'll still have accidents at about 20 months old, but they're very few and far between. And it's
amazing. Are your kids big? Because you're a giant yourself. Yeah, Zach is like 6'6", 6'7"?
Something like that. Yeah, maybe 6'5", 6'6". It depends on how good my posture is that day. But everybody wants to be tall, but if you haven't been tall, it's very much overrated. And, you know, even having big feet, everybody thinks it's cool, but I'm embarrassed. You know, and the only thing that I'm somewhat self-conscious about is the massive size of my feet. And, you know, my wife will catch me looking down, or she gives me some dress shoes or something. And I'm like, God, don't you think these look kind of bigger than my other ones? And she's like, what are you talking about? They all look clownish. You know, there's no way around it. But yeah, my son is, I mean, definitely off the charts. I don't even know, you know, we don't really know. We don't do the typical visits, and we're not on any sort of schedule, same, if you here. Will. Yeah, but
when he's around other kids his age, he's bigger than them.
Oh, he looks like should be in first grade.
Yeah.
He was potty trained at, I think, about 19 months roughly. Mm-hmm. And we thought, oh, you know, he's big. Maybe we'll try some 2T underwear. Well, then we'll try some 3T. And then by the time we kind of landed at 4 and 5T, something finally fit his big ass. You know, and so just that's just kind of it's not just he's tall, but he's like built.
Yeah.
You know, and he probably has the rear end of a freshman in college defensive end, you know, basically being 3 years old. He's you can see the potential and what he could grow into. And, you know, sports aren't a big push for us. It's just, I try to steer him into other things. We went to a Husker game, his first one ever. And he was really interested in the marching band. And I said, Julian, look how cool the band is. And he was really kind of getting into it. And I said, you know, you could be in the band one day. And he looked over at me and he was just disgusted. You know, how dare I even say something? So then and he wouldn't even say anything. And then I tried to mention it again. And then he's very respectful, mind you. And he cuts me off and he goes, Dad, I'm not going to be in the band. I'm going to play football. And then I tried one more time and then he just ignored me. You know, and I think that's, yeah. I'm the different type of dad. I'm trying to steer my children away from sports and into arts and music and, you know, and then let them make their decisions. But, at 3 years old, his mind's already set. He wants to go to the NFL. So that's, and we don't even watch sports. You know, we don't watch television.
Yeah.
The only football he's actually seen is in person. You know, it's just outside of maybe a little bit of Bluey at the barber shop, or, you know, every now and again, he might get to see 10 to 30 minutes of television a week. I mean, that's a stretch.
Wow, you're good. You're good. We're not so good about that. We do some of the YouTube stuff.
Yeah.
Like there's some guys that'll be building crap on YouTube, or there's some nice kids programs on YouTube.
Yeah.
Or whatever. The Lemmings and the Bear on Netflix or something like that. So yeah.
I'm not familiar with any of it, but you know, we've got this thing. I don't know what it's even called. I should know. I think it's called a Tony box. Have you ever heard of this? And it's like a square speaker box. And then
kids have those. Yep.
Okay, yeah. And you have the little characters, and it's like an audio book, basically, or stories or songs. And then have you ever heard of this new thing? It's called Farm Kids Radio. It's absolutely amazing. And you can go to farmkidsradio.com, or you can even search for Farm Kids Radio on YouTube. And they've got a live stream that's 24 hours a day. And it's literally children's music about farming. And it's, very innocent, really cool stuff. And it's actually really catchy music. So a big fan of Farm Kids Radio. So
yeah, we listened to it. Like I just started playing it on my phone and didn't like make a big deal of it. Just we were sitting around my kids and I started playing it and they started dancing. And
this
is awesome. They just went like, they totally changed when I just turned it on and I got a nonchalantly. I'm like, I wonder if they'll notice. And all of a sudden Wolfie's kind of like rocking back and forth. And then all of a sudden, it's...
Well, and if you listen, there's a couple songs, and there's one for each of my kids on there, you know, total. So there's Julian the Giant, and then there's little Vivian. So we've got... Our kids have their own songs on there. Nice. And, if any farm kids out in America want to have their own children's songs with their kids' names, just drop us a name in the comments, and we can definitely add that to some of the playlists and let our musical geniuses handle that one for them. But Farm Kids Radio, it's a lot of fun, and there just needs to be more quality content and more of a spotlight on agriculture in general, more so the culture of agriculture. you know, but we've really been courting a mega John Deere dealership group, and they saw us roll out some of these additional filters in real time yesterday. So, and you might know some of the buzzwords better, but like the, maybe it's called Exact Apply, or I'm not sure what some of these things are for John Deere. But if you go to TractorTuesday.com, you can go through the filters, and then there's a subgroup called additional filters. So one thing in particular, like with me, I'd love to have a John Deere tractor. You know, my back's been broken. I'm all beat up, and I've, my lower spine's all fused, and I've got all these things. I feel great, but man, I'm telling you, the reason why I bought the car for my wife that we did, the massage seats were awesome. So, I mean, for a guy like me, I would love to have, you know, massage seats in the Signature Series cab. Well, I'm used to basically the CVT and then that type of style in the Case IH tractor. So I hate the IVT. I hopped in my buddy Sean's. He got an 8R 310. Oh, it was awesome. I'm doing the massage seats. Everything's great. You know, I've got big hands. And I'm sitting there with the IVT, and it's like, I don't even know what to do with my fingers here to make these little adjustments. You know, but if I knew that there was an 8R with Command Pro, well, God, that's something I would filter for if I was on a different marketplace. So now at Tractor Tuesday, you can literally do an additional filter. Oh, Command Pro. Well, hey, maybe we can steer some of these red paint guys like me, or, you know, some of the AGCO guys that are used to a CVT. Well, hey, now you've got that Command Pro arm. You know, it might be something you're more interested in. And it looks like even on some of the New Age Ag Supply listings, we tagged Exact Apply on one of your sprayers that are on the site. So now, and we got that feedback from a local Deere dealer that said, look, you know, what we hate about some of these other sites, we get these auction results and then we come up with their valuations, but we don't even know the specs or how these units are even outfitted.
Yeah.
You know, and be like, oh, well, God, this one sold for only 180,000 and you know, all the other ones were 220. Well, did it have Exact Apply? It probably didn't.
It's a,
you know, but you don't know that. You know, these guys are in the business of selling data, but they do a piss poor job, in my opinion, of presenting all the facts and all the builds. Yeah. And again, with AI, it should be pretty easy, you know, and you should be able to filter these results and come up with these valuations a little bit more strategically and more intelligently. And that's what I'm proud of at Tractor Tuesday. We're not just some group that's licensed software or even had software proprietarily built and a part of our offering. And I'm telling you, almost every one of these groups, they've got an IT guy or two. You know, they've got like a webmaster or two gal or somebody in their office that, you know, can click a mouse and upload a couple of things, but they are not a software company. And so when a group tells us at Tractor Tuesday, hey, we want Exact Apply, we want that to be a subfilter, guess what? My guy Kyle tells the tech team, and about 3 minutes later, we've got that uploaded. It's in the live environment. So we pivot, we make changes in real time. And I think that's one of the most compelling things about Tractor Tuesday. We're not sitting on this antiquated software that we had built 3 years ago. Our development team of four is working basically 5.5, 6 days a week. And that's what we do, is we innovate, we develop. We've got side quests and other projects that nobody really see. And they don't quite understand, you know, they look at our inventory, everything looks great, you know, but we put out a press release this past week that said, look, we had I don't think we gave any numbers, but we had 73 items roughly that we could have forced into auction. Maybe about 65 of those units were on the up and up. They would have, you know, passed our due diligence. We would have had them slated for a date. But, you know, you talk to these farmers, if it's not some special unit, these end of the year auctions are proving to be a bloodbath. And yeah, we could have used that extra revenue, but we just thought, you know, we're going to do this for the better good of agriculture in theory. Let's try January 20th. Let's try February 17th and February 24th. Let's go to auction there. And everyone that we spoke with, my banker's cool. He agrees. He likes that perspective. In general, you call johnnysmithauctions.net and, oh, we're going to put you on this date. And that's it. You don't even have a choice. So not only do you give Johnny Smith 10% on a commission, but then you're told when you're allowed to auction your unit, you know, sell it yourself at Tractor Tuesday. That's the whole business model. Give you as a farmer or a dealership the tools to sell it yourself.
Power to the people, right?
Well, I mean, why not? You know, I mean, why do you need a middleman? And, and I just, and in some cases you do, you're doing a large estate sale, you're retiring. Yeah, great. Get the whole neighborhood there. Sell some hot dogs. Have a food truck.
Yeah.
make it an event. But if it's just a one-off deal or you're doing an inventory reduction, everything's got warranty. What's the point of an auction house? I will never understand that.
Exactly.
And I never have. And thankfully, Tractor Tuesday is not going anywhere. I think once the rest of the market figures this all out and seeing, you know, what happened in automotive is happening in ag, they'll be like, yeah, these guys were probably just a little early. Mm-hmm. And I hope that's how the story is written. But again, Scott Anderson, New Age Ag Supply, here with me, Zach Bosley from Tractor Tuesday. Is it Tuesday yet? I guess we're going to go with that. But thanks for paying attention, everyone out there. And if you have any questions, any great comments, please leave them below, and we'll catch you next Tuesday.
Well, it's not far to my grandpa's. At least it's not for me. And if the ground is kind, you can sow your hopes and chase some peace. Oh, the land can weave its wonders. Just you hold on tight, trust.